Welcome to Soundings, a weekly program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
I think we intellectuals and workers too are thinking about means too, and for the most developed workers activists, it is quite clear that it is impossible to get all these noble goals of democracy and high level of living standard and so on. It is impossible to get it without some losses. It is impossible simply to add all these things to the our old situation.
Well, I think there was a gap at the times of Marxism, but it is true that Marxism could purport to be a kind of total vision of life when the worker and the thinker really were involved in the same task.
Workers and thinkers in France and the Soviet Union, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations about intellectuals and the working classes in French and Soviet culture. You'll hear from scholars from the University of Paris, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Duke University, and the Institute for International Labor Movements in Moscow. I'll talk first with Jacques Rancière of the University of Paris and with Donald Reed of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Following that, you'll hear from Dirk Philipson of Duke University and from Leonid Gordon of the Institute for International Labor Movements in Moscow. Jacques Rancière's books include The Knights of Labor, a study of the French working class during the 19th century, available from Temple University Press. Donald Reed's most recent book is Paris Sewers and Sewermen, published last spring by Harvard University Press. Jacques, let me begin with you. Why is it that the French have a peculiar penchant for paying attention to or respecting the intellectuals in a fashion that we don't really have in the United States?
Well, I think that we can explain it first from the centralization, you know, of France, you know. Because in France there is a real centralization of intellectual life, you know. All centers around Paris. And I think that in some way intellectual French life kept something of the tradition of French monarchy, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that the academic life in France has really something which was inherited from the tradition. I think that our intellectual life in some way is still aristocratic and hierarchical.
John, let me bring you into the conversation. One of the fellows here at the Humanities Center suggested that the presence, the weight, the importance of the intellectual in French culture may have something to do with the language itself. Does that resonate at all? Where would you take that?
Well, there's certainly among the French a great respect for the language and an ability to speak the language well, and I think that that's part of a more general culture of respect for the language and mm-hmm. of intellectual values. I think that a question that I would direct to Jacques is whether or not this respect for the intellectual is changing. Is there, in today or in the future, do you see the same level of respect? We think of figures like Sartre and Foucault and Aron, all of whom have passed away in recent years. Will there continue to be major, highly respected figures like those?
Oh, I don't think that there will be a great change. Certainly, we had, particularly after the Second World War, a kind of characters as Sartre, that is to say the intellectual who can explain what is doing and what is doing in the historical process.
Does the explanation come from the engagement of the intellectual with the everyday lives of men and women, that is to say the popular culture at one level, labor is another big issue? How do the intellectuals mix it up with these everyday issues?
Oh, I think that in some ways, in fact, it's strange, but the intellectuals, in some way, in France, are the people who make the mediation between the everyday life, you know, and the government. Strangely, it seems that there is a kind of double mediation, you know, from the low to the high in France, you know. It seems that really the government, you know, the political class needs intellectuals to make them feel what is going on in the depths of society.
What I hear Jacques Rancière saying, Don Reed, is that people in France, to put it bluntly, give a damn about politics in a way that Americans do not. Whether you're talking about Republican democracy or whether you're talking about a sort of populism, is that too much of a stretch to talk in those terms?
Well, I think that you do. I think you do see that. Certainly, there is an attention to political discourse and political problems in France that you don't see in the United States. But I think that the point that Jacques is making is this role that intellectuals play as mediators, to use your word, mm-hmm. as mediators between the people and political figures, that the important role they play in articulating, on the one hand, their idea of popular aspirations, and but mm-hmm. on the other hand, politicians. One thinks of François Mitterrand as a wonderful example of a politician who I think feels a great need, if possible, to be surrounded by intellectuals, and he's been, I think, perhaps somewhat disappointed, but I mean, that would be something, his ideal would be to have mm-hmm. intellectual figures who were not his mouthpieces, but were part of his regime.
And well, in the United States, we have presidents who surround themselves with, the disparaging term would be the pointy heads and mm-hmm. the eggheads. And I mean, we look back to President Kennedy, who had, maybe it was mainly symbolic, but he had a relationship with people like Robert Frost. Why is it that in France we have novelists and poets and philosophers who matter in the everyday political discourse, the way politics gets itself conducted, in contrast to this country where it just doesn't happen that way? Jacques?
Oh, they don't always matter with it. We have to be a little more cautious. But I think that Don made the point, there is, and you, the question of language, you know, the importance of language, you know, in the social relations, in the relations between the low and the high, between the people and the upper class, I think uh-huh. it's something very important in France, a very important issue in the democratic life, and of course, the people who deal with language are in the center of the question.
you have identified one particular case, an individual whose name is Gabriel. Help me with the pronunciation here.
Gabriel Gonny.
And here is an individual who embodies this notion of what? The so-called lower class impulse to mix it up intellectually, to become part of the intelligentsia. Tell me about this person.
Yes, he was a joiner. He was a joiner. He was an autodidact. And he met some intellectual utopian thinkers in the France of the 1830s, the Saint-Simonians, who created a kind of religion, a kind of new religion of industry, of the proletariat, of the people. But what is interesting is that those people, you know, the Saint-Simonians, wanted precisely to have an army of workers be behind them. But the workers who came towards them didn't want it at all. They were attracted precisely by the idea of having another life, of breaking out with that kind of distribution of between the life of the man who thinks and the man who uses tools.
Let me be argumentative with you for a moment, Jacques Rancière. Don Reed, I want to draw you into the conversation. Are we reimposing? Are we looking back? You know, here's Professor Rancière sitting next to you. Is he just looking back on the 19th century and imposing a sort of wish list and agenda of 20th century politics on these characters? In other words, moving them out of the working classes and into the intelligentsia. What about that, Don?
No, I really don't think so. I think that what Jacques is doing is he's suggesting that we could. It's certainly true that some of what he talks about could be looked at in the 20th century, and we rarely explain the work of modern philosophers by their habitus, by where they go to work and the nature of their relations with their colleagues and their secretaries and the kind of places they live, etc. We think they have some higher aspiration to be engaged in the world of the mind, and I think that what Jacques is offering to us is saying there was some point at which very radical intellectuals, very radical, often people from the middle classes who wanted to help the workers, who felt work was demeaned, went to them and said, you know, your work is demeaned. No one realizes that work is the basis of society. We want to create a society where work, what you do, is respected. Hmm. And people looked at them and said, no, all that thinking you did to come up with this, that's what I want to do. And I think that is, as with, I think, a lot of the best work in history, it is at once historical, but it challenges our own conceptions, because the history we write now is at once an attempt to characterize accurately the past, but it is also obviously a reflection on the present.
Let's come at this issue of the relationship between workers and thinkers, the aesthetes and the laboring class, from another angle that Don Reed has suggested, and that is from a philosophical framework. Yeah. How have the philosophers looked on the laboring classes and said, this is how you men and women should be spending your time? Here is a project, a program philosophically for the way laborers should live their lives. Jacques Rancière, you're prepared here because you are both a historian and a philosopher.
Oh, I think that there never was a philosophical program telling how the workers, how the laborers much spend their lives. But there is a kind of initial separation or an initial dividing line, which in some way was the problem of philosophy. I mean that philosophy was not concerned with the problem of how the workers had to live.
Maybe
philosophy was concerned with the problem of the purity of thinking. Uh-huh. So I think when the kind of framework was drawn, and I think it was drawn very early, you can find it in the myths of Plato. And the problem of Plato is not to know how the workers have to spend their lives. The problem is to know who really has the right to think and who has not. Who should think and who should do another thing. And there is a very strange passage in Plato's Republic, passage when Plato says, now philosophy has been invaded by people which have nothing to do in it, people who would do their work, you know. And it's difficult to answer exactly what really he's referring to, you know.
So Plato here is not only kicking the poets out, he's kicking the laborers out of the Republic too. Have I got this right?
Yes, it's a bit subtle and intricate. In one way, yes, he puts the poets out because they don't do any useful work. Mm-hmm. And there are the artisans which are part of the city, and the poets are not part of the city. But the things are more complicated because the artisans are part of the city inasmuch they do their work and nothing more. And nothing more. And for instance, Plato looks at the Sophists as people who in fact, are artisans want to become philosophers. You know, the bad philosopher, the false philosopher, the wrong philosopher is, in fact, a man of tool, who purports to be a man of thinking.
Don Reed, let me draw you into the conversation. Are there modern-day analogs in French, or for that matter, American history, in which we find echoes of the scene that Jacques Rancière has been describing here? This difficult problem of categorizing human beings, the thinkers, the workers, the artisans. How about this?
I think it happens all the time. I think that...
nothing new.
Yes, in some sense, nothing new, although the discourse changes, and as Jacques mentioned earlier, one doesn't find philosophers now who are as explicit as saying, you know, shoemakers should make shoes, and if they do something else, they'll make bad shoes and, you know, bad philosophy or bad art. But I think that, and to use an example that Jacques has used in his own work, for instance, the work of the sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, who's very well known, probably certainly to Americans, the best known French sociologist, perhaps the best known French intellectual right now, one of the best known, very much makes a distinction between what constitutes the, in a sense, the life of the upper classes and the, mm-hmm. the aesthetic life of the upper classes and the aesthetic life of the lower classes, not to denigrate the lower classes, but very much in some sense to preserve their purity, that they, in fact, that they are closer to a kind of natural way of being. I mean, it is at once a separation of the kind that Jacques's talking about, but in the name of a valorization of this lower class. Mm-hmm. They, in fact, are not fake aesthetes here. But,
right.
And I think that that's just one example, but I think it's done all the time.
Donald Reed teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jacques Rancière is a professor at the University of Paris. Donald Reed's most recent book is Paris Sewers and Sewer Men, published last spring by Harvard University Press. Jacques Rancière is the author of The Knights of Labor, available from Temple University Press. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Workers and Thinkers in European Culture continues. You'll hear next from Dirk Philipson of Duke University and from Leonid Gordon of the Institute for International Labor Movements in Moscow.
Talk to me in historical terms about what do we call it, the Russian labor movement? How do you sort these threads out?
I would say that it's necessary to add one word, independent labor movement. Mm-hmm. Because officially speaking, there was labor movement, at any rate, trade union movement in Soviet Union. But speaking frankly, it was a very special kind of organization, which task, of course, was to some degree to help the workers, but much more important task of it was to help administrator and management.
The bureaucracy.
The bureaucracy, maybe. Uh-huh. But as to this new movement, it is the result of spontaneous workers' strike of miners, at which almost 500,000 miners. Uh-huh. And as a result of these strikes, strikes committee, then later they called workers' committee, was elected on each mines. Uh-huh. Now the process of formating all union workers' committee is in process.
Mm-hmm. Dirk Philipson, let me bring you into the conversation. What was the relationship between the intellectual class and the working class as this movement, this independent labor movement that Leonid Gordon has been describing? Where did that come from? What was it like?
Well, in fact, the story of the relationship between intellectuals and workers is a fascinating story in all of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, in as much that there is a huge gap between intellectuals and workers, and they did not have much tradition of talking to one another. And it turns out that they are really working for different political goals.
How would you characterize those goals, Leonid Gordon? What were the workers working for? What were the intellectuals working for?
First of all, I couldn't to be in full agreement with Dirk.
Tell me why not.
Because I think, of course, there are different goals between different groups of people in Soviet Union and other Eastern countries. Uh-huh. But I think this border, this gap in differences in goals are not simply between workers and intellectuals, but are between one part of intellectuals from one side and part of workers connected with these intellectuals, and another part of majority of the workers and maybe minority of the intellectuals part on other side.
All right, now who was agreeing? If we have to break this down, if we don't have a monolithic picture on both sides, who was agreeing from the workers with whom on the part of the intellectuals?
To my mind, the main part of the workers just now. Please remember that it's only 1 year old and uh-huh. nobody knows what will be in future. Majority of the democratically minded workers, the leader of this workers' strikes committee, are in the union of in the union with democratic intellectuals, especially with intellectuals who has so to say socially minded, mm. who think that in the future we are to follow democratic ideas of the West, but not limited us with only this following of these examples.
We should keep in mind at this point that there is historically no example and no model to go by as to how to go from a nominally socialist or communist society to something else.
How do the workers of the Soviet Union, regardless of how you want to characterize that, Dirk Phillips and Leonid Gordon, how do they think of a word like democracy? Dirk?
I think this is one of the most complicated terms to use in this debate because Americans think of something very different when they hear democracy, I think, than most people in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union.
Well, they think elected Republican democracy and congressmen and things like that. What's the difference in the Soviet Union?
Well, I think that the goal right now for many Soviet people I talk to and for many Eastern Europeans is really to try to reach the level that we have reached in the West, mm-hmm. but also to go beyond that. So typical example would be that most people you ask as to what the ideal model would be, say Sweden and not the United States or Western the rest of continental Europe.
Mm-hmm. I remember a recent visitor here at the center, a man named Boris Kargalitsky, yes. came to us from the Moscow City Council. He said, sure, we want to model ourselves on American behavior and political theory up to a point. We do not want the McDonald's culture, he said. How about this, Leonid Gordon?
I'm quite sure that Boris is representing one of the wing of democratic and working class movement, but not all of them. And I agree with Dirk that majority of workers has its goal to follow some democratic example, but go beyond that. And I think the main difference is in the type of social organization. I doubt very much for the worker this problem of McDonald's culture is so important, mm-hmm. but the problems of social safety, the problems of preventing unemployment, the problems of preserving of these feelings of safety at workplaces, which uh-huh. they really has just right. now. This is what is the most important.
Dirk Phillipson?
It is very important to keep in mind in this respect, in this regard, that life in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union was grim in a lot of ways. People were not rich. Things did not work very effectively. But what they did have was, for example, full employment. They had 100% childcare coverage. They had good national health care plans.
Didn't have to worry about
these
things.
And they did not have to worry about these things. And so while the West looked very appealing to people in terms of consumer goods, in terms of freedom to express yourself, freedom uh-huh. to travel, people did not pay as much attention to the fact that in many Western countries, they did not have the security that people previously had in the East. In general terms, I think it is, again, important to keep in mind that the situation in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe, I think, could be described as one of both great openness and great possibility on the one hand,
and great uncertainty and great fear
on yeah. the other hand. Uh-huh. That is to say, there is a genuine democratic debate going on at the bottom of society to an extent that we have not witnessed in America for a long time, I think. But there's also great uncertainty as to where to go and what will be possible. And I would like to follow up with a question, Leonid. To what extent did Soviet intellectuals think about a third way, as most Eastern European intellectuals talked about, a third way between communism and between communism on the one hand and capitalism on the other, a third alternative?
I am to say that judging or our sample and personal experience, I am to say that still majority of the intellectual, or maybe better to say intelligentsia, and majority of workers activists still thinking about some kind of third way. Of course, it is very difficult to say what does it mean.
Right.
But at any rate, the example of Sweden or Denmark or Dutch or Austria is much more close to the ideals of this part of workers' movement and intellectuals.
Would you call it a social market economy, social
yes.
democratism?
Yes, 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 or something of that kind. Mm-hmm. Then situation in United States, or let us say in United Kingdom, and so on. But if we'll compare three ways, continuation of old communistic way, or maybe some it's a new form, United States and United Kingdom ways, and Sweden ways, of course for most of the workers and intellectuals, the last two, Sweden way and United States, is much more closer and much more preferable than continuing of old ways. So it is, as you have told, it is a selection in one deep, so to say. Majority of intellectuals and workers in Soviet Union prefer Sweden way, understanding in the same time that this Sweden way is more closer to American way, to the old communistic way.
Leonid Gordon is a professor at the Institute for International Labor Movements in Moscow. Dirk Philipson teaches in the Department of History at Duke University. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Workers and Thinkers in France and the Soviet Union is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 565. That's program number 565. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Next week, Allegory and Apocalypse, two conversations about English literary history. Wayne Pond will talk with Gordon Teske of Cornell University and with Stephen Goldsmith of the University of California at Berkeley. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Workers and Thinkers, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for two conversations about intellectuals and working class culture in France and the Soviet Union. You'll hear from scholars from the University of Paris, the Institute for International Labor Movements in Moscow, the University of North Carolina, and Duke University. Workers and Thinkers, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.